We're going to be moving from the discussion last time of the overview of the concept of story, the power of story, and of writing a new story. We're going to look in the next four seminars about how to do that. We're going to look at the seven steps to deconstruct the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. And that's the roadmap system, the seven step. The roadmap is the acronym, as you know, of the seven steps of looking at understanding a story, whatever that story is, and how can we understand it and revise it or construct a new one. And remember, there are a number of examples of roadmap case studies in the ebook link that I sent you. I think 32 examples from people who are licensed and specially certified who have done this training and wrote either on themselves or their clients. So there's some good examples there. And I'm going to wait until after we've had a chance to go through the roadmap system. One of the reasons I keep the numbers small here is to provide a way that we'll each have a way of interacting as well as later to support your practices. But after we do the roadmap system, after the first five seminars, then we'll schedule a time for each of you to present your roadmap case study. It can be either on yourself or on a client, and we'll devote about 15 minutes at the beginning to that for you to read your roadmap case study and then to have a class discussion of that. So that will be something that you can look forward to and look forward to sharing with us so that you'll get the experience of bringing it together and using it to see in what ways that you think it might be useful for you as well as for your clients. So this is one of the ways that we put what we're doing into an output channel. There's a whole lot of very new research about how much better we learn by putting it in an output channel. Even recently, one study out of England showed even when we read something out loud, we retain it better than when we read it silently. So there's a whole bunch of things on that, but this is simply one way to apply it and for you to have the experience of applying it, and then you can help your clients do something very similar as well. So any thoughts, questions, things you'd like to discuss in any way before we start with
Dave?
Yes.
It's Deborah. I'm sorry. The roadmap case studies are where? You've mentioned them a couple times.
The
where
link,
can we find them?
The link that I've seen, I'll resend this. It's a link to an ebook that I've edited. I'll send you the link to the ebook as well as the page again to everybody so you'll have easy access to it. It was in a couple of
okay.
earlier emails. It may have slipped your attention because that wasn't the focus in the beginning. So I'll resend that. So I'm glad you
okay. I do have the link to your mentorpath.com with the syllabus and all of that, but it's not in that.
I'll send both of those links to everybody. Yes. Yeah, so thanks for
okay. Thank you. Thank you.
What else? Anything at all you'd like to discuss?
This is Kristen. I found it interesting in the reading when it was talking about people going back to the same behaviors and creating the same behaviors. With that subconscious level that we had discussed in the first seminar, if they had abandonment issues, that if they come across somebody that doesn't abandon them, they'll essentially self-sabotage the situation to make you abandon them. And it was interesting to me in certain people in my life. It was a very interesting aspect of the reading as I was going through and that pathway that they continue to write that story even though they're doing it on a subconscious level.
Yeah, and that's an example of something that we can listen for as mentor coaches, to listen for the unconscious patterns, the emotional, the attachment, the behavioral patterns that someone may not be aware of. And when we think about, as we discussed, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. There is a whole lot that we're not aware of that we just routinely do in a default way, and we only see the evidence of what those algorithms are, those patterns, that basic operating system. We see the evidence of it, and only if it doesn't work or we see something we may improve, do we really address it, because usually it works just great to not have to pay attention and not do energy for something that we repeatedly do. Because when we repeat something, our brain rewires to make it automatic to conserve energy. And that's been so from an evolutionary standpoint about how beneficial it is. It's also, though, when something doesn't work, we keep repeating it and hoping it will get better, or inhabiting the story we want to believe, but yet we're repeating the behavior that may be limiting, that may have a glass ceiling, that may be something that we could address in a conscious way and look at change. That's exactly what the roadmap system is about, is a way to inform us as coaches about how to listen to the stories that our clients tell, whatever that is. It may be about what happened in the executive suite a couple of hours ago. It may be about what happened at home last evening with a partner. It may be any number of things, but we're listening for the things that may be helpful if we collaborate to focus together with a client and to look at it as a story that the client's creating. And that's exactly what these seven steps are, is to understand how we're creating a story, and then at the same time to have a system of a way to change that if we want to. And remember one thing. Your client is not going, and the people you listen to that you see repeating those patterns, they're not going to see it as a story. Because to them, it's not a story. It's just the way things happen. That's life. And that's where we come in about collaborating with someone to move to a position to objectively look at it, to create a collaborative alliance, to look together, to develop self-reflection, to co-create an empathic listening from inside the system of the client to understand and look at what needs to be revised. And in the sense of remembering that each of your clients don't experience their story as a story, but just as the way things happen. Margaret Atwood said it really clearly in her book, Alias Grace. When you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but it's only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood. You know, sometimes it's way better than that, but it's the process and the principle of looking at it as a story that allows us to begin to understand it. And that's the development of the self-reflective capacity. And there are a couple of articles in the Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind most recently. The most important quality for success, they were looking at executives, but I think this is across the board, is the ability to develop self-awareness, self-reflection, and self-regulation, all the self aspects, but primarily to develop self-regulation, and we do that by self-reflection, to be able to reflect on and understand what we're experiencing, what we're feeling, without acting on it. So those are some really important aspects. And thank you for mentioning that. And this is, I think, one of the important aspects of the discussion, is so that you can apply it and see what see how it sounds when you apply it in a way. You'll be doing that in the roadmap case study, but this is also a way to bring confusion or thoughts or questions or even different points of view for us to discuss. So anything else? Well, I'll move into the seminar then and put us on lecture mode, and then we'll also have some time at the end. So if there are any questions or comments, jot them down. I'm very eager to hear what your thoughts are and you know, how you're seeing the application of this and questions about that.
David?
I heard a note as I hit the conference mode. So we're back in discussion mode now. Was there a question?
Yeah, David, forgive me. For some reason, the call just failed, and I just dropped back on. This is Erica. As you're going through the seminar or conference mode, what shall we be following? Is in the books that we received via email? What's the best resource to kind of follow along as you're speaking?
Okay, two things. One is, there's an annotated outline that you can print, and I'm going from that same outline, basically. So you're going to be tracking what we're talking about by going with the outline. And that's
okay. And this is the wellness outline, correct? The Outlook wellness outline?
The one on the page where you have 12 ports, and it's the outline of the 12 seminars.
Perfect. And okay, thank you. That's clarification.
Okay, the other is the syllabus. That has the reading and the curriculum that corresponds with each of the 12 seminars. And ideally, that would be done before the seminar and for you to do the exercises and work tools that are the companion to that curriculum component. For what you have, the workbook portion, the exercises and work tools, will be in gray. Now, I'm going to send each of you, as my compliments, as I mentioned last time, a client workbook at the end of the training so you can get an idea of what it would be like for your clients to use the workbook. But for now, that workbook is in the is in gray, so you'll get an idea of where placement or alignment would be. So everything is there, the outline and the syllabus to correspond with the curriculum reading for each of the 12 seminars. Is that
wonderful. Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Okay, absolutely. Okay, we're going to talk about how to go about writing a new story, how to understand and revise or create a new one, the principles and practice of change step by step. Now, the steps are simple, but they're not always easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it requires us to change the way we think about our lives. For example, breaking a bad or outdated habit, or simply departing a comfort zone, developing new ways of doing things, the discomfort of the unknown, and remaining disciplined over the long term. Now, in this seminar, we're going to look at the first three steps of the roadmap process to create a new story. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines. So remember we talked about operating systems, how computers have operating systems within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex system of software, the algorithms that contain instructions, protocols, and couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Now, our stories, life, business, career, relationship, money, wellness, our stories have an internal operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions that generate our behaviors. So we're about to deconstruct that system in order to study it, understand it, and then to decide where it needs editing, rewriting, or simply updating. So step one, recognize authorship of your life story. This is the R of the roadmap. Remember the premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. It doesn't just happen to us, even though it may feel that way. Every day begins a fresh page. And the dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us. They're created by us. Yet, so often, the story closest to us, our own, is the most challenging to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how do we tell our stories to ourselves to know what to keep and what to change? Now, your clients will probably recognize that they author their own stories. But as you listen, you'll hear a belief or an assumption that ghost writes a storyline that can be limited or simply outdated. I'll give you an example in a minute of an elephant who's an elephant in every way except for one little belief. So here are four principles in recognizing authorship. And these are ones that correspond to how the mind and the brain work. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined in a small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will try initially to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant stays in the area determined by the length of rope. Now, fast forward. The elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6 to 7 tons, and it could easily break this little rope, but it doesn't. Because earlier as a baby, it couldn't. This 6.5 ton adult elephant is constrained by an assumption based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines the behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. Some things you have to believe in order to see. And our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. So the beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception not only of what surrounds us, but includes what and how we select, register, and process everything. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect, because we always make our beliefs come true. Remember the two anthropologists. If you believe no one will love you, you'll interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way. So you won't be lovable or will block someone from experiencing intimacy. You'll teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumption. Also, consider this. Carefully select the people you spend time with. On the average, we are the average of the 5 people we're around the most. So do you like the results? Are they kind, successful, disciplined, or achievers? Or whatever is of greatest value to you? Choose your friends and colleagues well. It makes a difference. We'll return to that about how states of mind and emotions are contagious. Principle three, a new story can only occur in the present moment. This is one principle that distinguishes mentor coaching, the focus on now and next. For example, social scientists have discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer, not only because there is a direction of focus, but also because they've put it in the output channel and they're more likely to act. For example, when you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates 35% over the next 4 months. Other behaviors with increased frequency. Asking people if they intend to eat certain foods, to exercise, to work out, to diet. In the basic coaching model, the final step of each session is to frame an action and a plan for the next week that the client intends and commits to do. Principle 4. Our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find a way to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. The brain and the mind both seek closure, and people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but when they're asked for a reason, they readily give one. Here's an example. A series of studies reported by Dr. Dan Gilbert of Harvard showed volunteers words flashed on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was such a short time, it was actually subliminal programming. It was 1/50th of a second, so they were unaware of the words that were shown, and they couldn't pick them out or guess even from a multiple choice, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers walked more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform less well on tests. When these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, there were a couple of responses. Well, they didn't know, but they didn't say they didn't know. They quickly decided what was the cause or the reason. They would say when they were shown the video of, you know, of responding a little bit more slowly when the word elderly, first they didn't believe it. And then when they were shown evidence of it, they would say, well, I was a little tired when I did the test, or I've been traveling for the last few days and I haven't slept. In other words, they denied the actual cause and superimposed their own cause. Each was unaware of the fact they were falsely attributing cause and effect. This illustrates how our minds bring closure and our brains end dissonance by finding a causal explanation. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any other number of mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth. A finish without an ending. Now, in the workbook portion, I would suggest reviewing the exercise in step 1, recognize authorship of your story, on page 1.9, and look specifically at the plot, the core themes and storylines of life stories. Here's an example of recognizing authorship. A woman wrote me after reading my book, Destiny, An Uncommon Journey. It's an allegory of self-development with destiny of ship undergoing transformation inside and outside. She said, that could be a profile of my life. I'm sure a lot of other people experience the same thing. I don't want to relive this pattern over and over again. There seems to be this circuitry I keep entering. Destiny had to trust in order to learn. When will I learn to trust? I keep peeling back more layers. How many layers to these distortions are there? And she elaborated how frustrating therapy had been for several years with several different therapists. And I wrote back the following response, and this may sound a little familiar. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs ghostwrite that story. When you peel back all the layers of the onion, what's left is not a pure, unadulterated onion, but nothing, since you've destroyed the object of the quest. Instead of the model of layers going deeper to discover the next layer, consider generating a new story, going forward rather than backward, looking at possibilities rather than problems. You can even assess when you're rewriting an old story and plagiarizing an earlier version of yourself. Then you can edit the repeating storyline or create a new one. She decided to work together in mentor coaching for a few months to create a new story. She now writes stories for a major publication, is working on a second screenplay. As we ended, she asked me if I would be in the audience when she was nominated for an Academy Award. Step 2, own your story. And here I'd suggest particularly looking at the assumptions and motivations constructing storylines, that exercise on page 1.13. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like adding a new diet or adding a health club membership, will likely not have an impact unless you change the software. As we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be useful. And this is in your outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Here are some examples of empowering beliefs. And this is from the workbook. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs can also influence reality and behavior. These may or may not be conscious. These may be the shadow story that goes in the opposite direction of the surface story. An example, well, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. Now, each of these are coachable moments. Each limiting assumption, each blind spot that someone has that may be limiting what they do, those can be highlighted and examined as they occur. And also, that's why, as I mentioned last time, I will request permission with every client I work with to be able to interrupt that client at a point that it may be helpful for both of us to look together at what they just created. And I'll certainly want them to interrupt me and give them permission anytime they decide. The way you figure out how to adapt or survive is usually the way you continue to adapt or survive. Your first survival strategy usually becomes your favorite. But favorite even implies a choice. First, you have to experience this not as a choice, or I'm sorry, as a choice rather than just the way things are. Now, notice that the examples I gave include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. We're in a unique position as mentor coaches to observe patterns. The brain seeks patterns. Metaphors and narratives become brain structure. One example is attachment patterns. Here's a brief illustration that's kind of vivid and kind of goofy, but think about the human equivalents. I raised a hatching of wild ducks, mallards, in a pen that I constructed at my ranch. The pen was necessary to protect them from critters until they're old enough to fend for themselves and flee danger by flying, especially since I'm there only on weekends. Now, this necessitated, it was a large pen, like six feet by 4 feet, but they had to live in the pen, partly submerged in the water so they could practice swimming at the edge of the lake until they could learn to swim and develop naturally for about 5 to 6 weeks. So I finally opened the gate of the pen. I thought they would be all excited and fly off and, you know, they'd be beating their chests with freedom, but they wouldn't get out of the pen. Despite their freedom to swim in two beautiful lakes or just fly away, confinement in a small pen had become a comfort zone. I had to force them out. I literally dumped the pen upside down and force them out. And as soon as they were released, all 12 moved as a group, never more than a few inches apart, a habit they formed in the pen. They continued to fly and swim in this really tight pattern, kind of in a circle, for a long time. Now, think about your attachment patterns, the default behaviors of your relationships with important people. Some may have been etched early on with essential people in your life. If you have a pattern of subtle codependency, of getting somebody to do something for you that you really can do for yourself, it will show up in very veiled and subtle ways, too, maybe not so veiled and subtle. Even though you've incorporated it as a model, it's a default mode. Perhaps you use it with children or a spouse or colleagues or friends. It's still a choice. And that's the essence of what we're looking at now, of how everything that you do, whatever you think and feel and experience, is a choice. whatever you experience, you either create or you agree to. And you can choose to continue, or you can create another pattern to make another habit. It's like saying just because you have a history with someone doesn't mean you have to keep repeating it. Here's an example. I was working with a CEO of a successful company that he founded. His son had a condition that if he took medication, he could remain without symptoms. He had a bipolar disorder, and the son was in his early 30s, and he had had, at that point, 6 different major episodes since his early 20s where he would have to be hospitalized for several months at a time, and my client would go to wherever he was hospitalized, take an apartment for at least 2 to 3 months, and help his son back on his feet. The beginning of another episode occurred when we were working together, and my client was about to repeat the pattern he had engaged in the last decade and a half with his son in crisis to rescue him, because he had orchestrated the equivalent of several midnight helicopter rescues from a Mexican prison. And as I questioned him carefully, he acknowledged his efforts actually had made no difference. It helped him to feel effective, like he was doing something loving, but he recognized that it made no difference. And I challenged him because I thought it was making a difference for his son to perpetuate an attachment pattern, a way that he became attached to his dad. And my client was enhancing his sense of helplessness, that by now, each of the episodes he recognized affected his health and his effectiveness in running his company by focusing on what he couldn't determine, not on what he could determine. And it seemed he needed to stop rescuing. So part of what we did in coaching was that I recommended that he and his wife both attend a CODA meetings, Codependence Anonymous, for people who have loved ones who will not take care of themselves. This was one of the most loving dads that I know, but he was caught in a pattern of rescue that he hadn't been able to escape. And it was literally one of the hardest things he had done to not rescue his son after he recognized that he needed to respond in a different way, in an adult-to-adult way. And he and I continued to work. He and his wife went to CODA meetings, and my client let go. And the son's hospitalization was averted, actually, and his son is now taking meds consistently for the first time in his adult life. He's been doing that for 7 years, and he has a substantial position at a major university and has started a business startup that is about to revolutionize one little sector of the economy. So it is a success story to change patterns in this way. So a fundamental precept of step two of owning your story, as I just mentioned, whatever you experience, you either create or you accept. So if there's something you're not liking, then consider either not creating it or not accepting it. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about point of reference. A point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories usually have a premise of an external point of reference. Their theme can include passivity or perhaps resignation and include the experience of helplessness. They may transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. So here are some characteristics of those with an external point of reference. And again, each one of these, in my view, are coachable moments. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. They believe they can only change things by changing the outside source or person, which of course ensures ineffectiveness and frustration. To have as a premise that you need to change someone else in order to be happy or be effective. When they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and disconnecting the indicator rather than pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. This is what we coach toward. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility, and their theme is effectiveness. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own story. So here are some of those characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. Or when they see a result that doesn't work, they simply decide not to continue. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they recognize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion. To recognize active versus passive positions, these are some things that we can hear in how someone constructs their story. These are some of the things that I want to emphasize. All of this at least can be done as good over the telephone as face-to-face. And there are some advantages over the telephone because you're not distracted with all the visual cues and the beginning and the end, and you have just as much intuitive capacity over the telephone as you do live time with somebody sitting across from you. So, active versus passive positions. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. These are all passive construction indicating a passive position in terms of writing one's own story. Now, you have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist, the idea of a gun was enough to change everything. These passive positions disown the feeling, thoughts, or actions as an active creation, as if the feeling you create makes you its victim. Remember we talked about that briefly last time. This passivity can mask personal initiative. So, rather than managing, overcoming, countering, or medicating a feeling or an obstacle, the first step is to recognize that even though it seems to just happen, you generate the experience. You can then examine the meaning you attach. And again, insight and understanding alone do not generate a positive, successful story. Coming to the end of the past isn't enough. You have to create a new story to inhabit. And the only way to successfully end an old story is to completely reside in a new one that you create. So, the first two steps, once recognizing and owning a story, step three, assess the storylines and plot. So, recognizing and owning allow you then to objectively assess what's working and what's not. And remember this, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. And you can't just present a simple explanation or have information and remove an existing neural network. Teachers know this. A teacher can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neuronal network from a student's brain. You can't list the three reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it will rearrange somebody's neural network and neuronal pathways. But change can occur. It's a process, not an event. So this step is to assess the beliefs to see if they're limiting to try out other beliefs. And to really look at what we're doing as based on beliefs, based on assumptions, And those beliefs are ghostwriting our behavior. So we may want to look with a client, for example. What's another way of looking at this? Is this way of looking at it limiting in any way? What's a different perspective? Are there questions you're afraid to ask? What do you really want? And what do you need to let go? Now, these are two exercises I really want to highlight in the workbook. Of all the exercises in the entire workbook, these are the two that I most regularly will use with a client, and often on the very front end, to distinguish and address needs and ideals. And these two exercises are important because needs are essential requirements, a necessity for mind, body, and spirit. And unmet, frustrated needs create discomfort. And the important thing about needs is to find ways to meet them, because you can't substitute one need for another. And if you disregard a need, it won't go away. It will let you know in some way that it's still there, even over time. Ideals are internal standards of excellence, of value. They're a personal model of an internal guide to purpose. To say it a little bit of a different way, living up to a personal, attainable ideal is the only thing that I know that generates a sense of self-esteem. To have an ideal that's attainable and living up to it results in self-esteem. To not live up to an ideal results in a feeling of shame. And that's the most difficult feeling to deal with. Guilt is different. You've transgressed. You've done something. You can always find some retribution or some makeup. Shame, though, is when you fail to live up to an ideal. So this requires looking again at some things and replanning. So I will ask a client to look at needs and ideals and pick the top three needs and the top three ideals and send them to me, maybe in a first coaching session. And then when I have those three needs and three ideals that are the top three of each for the client, of that entire list of ones that you'll see in the workbook portion, that will help guide both of us so that we can align whatever strategies and goals with their needs and ideals to be sure they're all going in the same direction. When all of somebody's going in the same direction, that's dynamite. There's a case illustration in the workbook component of someone where there was misalignment of needs and ideals with their strategies and goals, which created a kind of an inherent conflict. Now, here's a vignette that illustrates how clarifying needs and ideals and aligning them with goals and strategies can be helpful. Notice, and this is just a vignette, but notice how we can learn from someone's language and behavior the assumptions that drive their stories. Client said, "I feel like I've been cheated at the end of the day. It's 9 o'clock at night and I haven't eaten yet. The way my schedule goes, I come home from work and my wife hands our son to me, so I'm in charge of him from 5 to 7. I love that, but I'm tired. She needs the time to do her computer work. Then I finish work from the day, and it's at least 9 o'clock at night, and I'm stressed out." I highlighted two aspects of what he said. I've been cheated, and the way my schedule is. I pointed out that he was speaking as if he were not writing his own story, as if it were ghostwritten by someone else and not even approved by him. I knew he was in charge of his own schedule. And then I asked him simply, "Let's look at why you're writing your daily story in a way that you don't like." And he paused. He was kind of dumbfounded. He said, "Well, I guess I feel like I have to. I feel like I have to support my wife and take care of our son in that way. My work just spills into the evening, into my private life. So I don't even work out or even relax. I even have to take calls from my people during the time with my son. Something is assumed and expected of me when I walk in the door. I feel like somebody else is in control of me. And I said, let's play that back to listen to what you hear yourself say. And he immediately responded. He said, it's like somebody else is writing my story for me. And I said, you're not assuming that you own your story or your company. He said, well, how can I protect the time with my son? And I said, every yes, you have to pay for it with at least one no. And those yeses are getting really expensive. No protected time to be totally with him, for him and you. No total immersion in free play or even for exercise for yourself. I said, let's start at the beginning. Assume every day is a blank page. There's nothing on it until you create it. How ideally would you like your day to be? He then went through that, and recognizing that he was in charge of his schedule, he proactively created a schedule and looked at the times that he was in a reactive mode, how much of his day was taken up by people who would do a curbside consult or pop into his office or catch him when he was at lunch. And he scheduled those times for a certain segment of the day, and people learned to approach him at those times and to schedule them. He also had his assistant schedule telephone calls for a segmented 45 minutes of the day, not peppered throughout the day where he would have to change states of mind, which can be very draining. So when he finally was getting it, reflecting on what we were saying, I said, I want to share a hunch to see if it's useful for us to consider. I suspect the frustrations that you haven't spoken fully until now about your company, your marriage, have been there at a subliminal level and get communicated so that others feel it in some way. Your wife, your employees, your customers. I'd guess it registers as something not working quite right, and you or they don't know exactly why until it lights on something that makes it make sense, even though that may not be the real cause. And he immediately said, yeah, like when I blow up or fire somebody. And I said, well, that would end the tension for a little while. He said, yeah, but then I'm off to the races again. So he structured in a completed way then, a way to meet his own needs, to take care of the foundation of his wellness, to create a personal and professional mastery. His professional day ended at 5 o'clock. He took no calls after that. That day was structured until then, so he was immensely more effective, and he had more time during the day, and he even created a time to schedule a workout during the day because things were so much amazingly more effective. And by having clear boundaries where he could be totally immersed in work during the day, he could be totally free at home, and both were restorative for him. Now, part of the assessment of your story, understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often aren't aware of having them, but just assume again that we see things the way they are. For example, if you read, and this will be useful for you in working with clients because this is going to be in some way or another with every client you work with who undergoes a change. If you read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, an old model where anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, then it makes sense to stop. Or uncertainty means a wrong decision. Now, a current paradigm, and this is where you may help the client understand how their mind and brain is working, in that whenever they experience something new, whenever they do something new or make a change, they're going to experience some uncertainty and trepidation, maybe even anxiety, but in a new model. This is the P of the roadmap, program new identity. In a new model, this simply is validation that they're moving ahead, a signpost of progress, not, as in the old system, anxiety equals danger, it makes sense to stop. Now, another example. We need to be afraid of the right thing. We usually fear what's easily remembered or what we can't control. For example, it's far more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we feel no control, so that may feel more dangerous. Or smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their life by 1 day. Way safer than cars. People also fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than they do food entering their bodies on a daily basis that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. So, one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is the development of the awareness that we foster in our clients and the ability for them to develop self-empathy, to be empathically resonant with themselves, to think about and reflect on what we do. This means we can learn from our experiences and from the experiences of others. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see which work well. So, listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. We always perceive and create inside to match outside, and outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like or dislike in another person, and don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. So, if you want to find out what you believe about yourself and the world, look around at your life. It's the self-statement, the mirror of what exists inside you. If you feel preoccupied or disrupted internally, you'll probably notice that your house or office or car reflects that experience. All that you say in the syntax of thought, feeling, and behavior is about yourself. Remember, too, everyone else also makes self-statement. What you say about me doesn't tell me about me, it tells me about you. What someone says about you has everything to do with the speaker, even though it's focused on you. So, listen, take in new information, but don't take it personally. So, this is part of what we do in listening to our clients, to put our ego in a blind trust, to recognize that all that they're saying is about themselves. They are also showing us exactly what it's like to be them, so that when we experience some kind of specific discomfort with a client, we're an accurate barometer of what that client is experiencing. So then when it is workable to do so in the working lives, to get curious together about what the client is experiencing so that both of you can become aware of that. So another example, if someone's being critical and judgmental of you, it's your decision whether to believe and accept that point of view. Consider if you're assigning an aspect of yourself to someone else. If you believe you lack a certain quality, you may focus on someone who exhibits it. This reliance on someone functioning for you and on an external point of reference for validating can be limiting. So, in order to grow, we must move our point of reference to an internal one, to own responsibility for our life and its expression. That's exactly what we strive to do with our clients as the process. So, a couple of things in closing. Listen for repetitions of the old story. We each generate a story with a recurring plot. We repeat its continuing formula over time, even if it's not a winning one. Each repetition may more deeply reinforce basic assumptions and even a false belief about being a victim of fate. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious is likely attributed to fate. To re-enter an old story and attempt to write a better ending creates a variation of that scenario, a new edition of the same process. The more you run away from something, the more you engage it, so the more apparent it becomes. Sometimes you can recognize something the first time only by denying it. And at times, we repeat just to see in relation to a fixed point of reference how much we've changed. This is when we're being insightful. Each time we return to the chorus of the song, the repetition is satisfying, but those same words are different, for more of the lyrical story has unfolded, and we see more of the evolving journey at each juncture of repetition. Each time you return to a particular pose in yoga, it's a reflection of how far you've come since you did that initially. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. That's important so that you can make them conscious and see which ones are working. If your personal or professional life is not as gratifying as you'd like, if you believe you've not attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know specifically and consciously what those goals are. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically yet dream vaguely? And to each of you, do you have a business plan for your coaching practice? And as a sidebar here, I have a template. If you're interested, we'll return to that in discussion. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from an anticipated failure. Listen for that in clients, too, as they look at their commitments of what to do at the end of the coaching session. If they say, I'm going to try, then I would immediately challenge that, because trying says there's not a full commitment. You know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction. When somebody says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. And as mentor coaches, we build in accountability by asking, by when? Our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end for time limited. And finally, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, when you work out and rest well, at the time and especially later. Now, we'll return to this in Module 10 on Wellness Story, but here's the prologue. Listen to somatic language, to the message in each pain, discomfort, dis-ease, change of function, exhilaration, sensation, renewed energy. There are no accidents within the system, the story of your body. As with any complex system, a change of one component affects every aspect of that system. It's a zero-sum game. Of your body's 11 systems, only two have memory, the nervous and the immune. A new story involving your body inscribes new text for these two systems and benefits your entire body. Now, here's a final thought and a homework, if you're inclined. Schedule an appointment with yourself. Now, the passive version is if I find time. Schedule an appointment with yourself to meditate, and schedule an appointment with yourself to brainstorm. Many of you already do meditation. Here's a brainstorm suggestion. And these are two separate times because they're two different parts of your brain. So here's the prompt for the brainstorm session. Everyone on earth has one thing in common. Our choices in life define us. Those who provide service to others, such as authors, money managers, therapists, leaders, teachers, coaches, especially parents, have their answers counted many, many times. What will yours be? Make it matter.